Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. My name is Dan Safarik. Greg Lindsay is off today. My guest is Peter Wynn Rees. Peter Wynn Rees is the Professor of Places and City Planning on the University College of London Faculty of the Built Environment. He was previously the City Planning Officer for the City of London, where he led the planning and regeneration of this World Business and Financial Center from 1985 to 2014. He's lectured internationally, advised developers in cities around the world on urban planning and design, and made frequent media appearances on these topics. Peter was the subject of a BBC profile on The Culture Show and was included in the Debrett's 500 list of the most inspiring and influential people in Britain. Numerous awards have recognized his achievements, and in 2015, he was appointed a CBE for services to architecture and town planning. Peter, welcome.
Good to be with you, Dan.
Thank you so much. Well, you're here today partially because you have yet another honor to put in your crown, which is the Lynn Beadle Award from the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, which is my employer. And a little bit of background on that for the uninitiated. Lynn Beadle was the founder of the council. He was a civil and structural engineer, and the first award that the council gave in 2003 was in his, well, actually it was to him, and then gradually our awards program has grown to encompass something like 28 categories, and but we always try to keep the personal part of it. So we always try to honor someone who is very integral to the world of tall buildings. And oftentimes, you know, they're not necessarily from dead center in the industry, which I would probably describe as architecture, engineering, and developers. And this is certainly the case this year. So, Peter, what do you think receiving the Lynn Beadle Award says about your relationship with the world of tall buildings?
Well, of course, it comes as a surprise and is a great honour, and I'm very humbled to be receiving it the same year when the Fezzer Khan Lifetime Award is going to Hanif Kara, who I've known for many years in the London building scene. And if it wasn't for Hanif, an awful lot of now very famous buildings would never have left the architect's drawing boards. They wouldn't have stood up without him, as they say. So, indeed, an honour, very humbling. And sometimes perhaps a little difficult for me to get my mind around, which I've been trying to do since I heard the news, because I've had a love-hate relationship with tall buildings. Quite often the latter, I have to say, and I've given vent to some of those feelings at CTBUH conferences. In fact, I've often said that my connections with the CTBUH have been much more for the UH part than for the TB part. It's urban habitat that really interests me. It's the quality of places, which I suppose is what you'd expect coming from a professor of places. Tall buildings do have a purpose, but I always see them as a last resort, not as a first solution. And I was indeed caught up in a spate of tall building in the City of London back around the millennium, when this World Financial Centre ran out of office space for all the companies, financial institutions that wished to be here. We're a very small area, just 1 square mile. We couldn't spread outwards, so we had to go upwards. And that was why we planned a small and very tight cluster of high-rise office buildings in the eastern part of the city, as far away as possible from the impressive skyline marker of St. Paul's Cathedral, and tried to shape it with, in its way, distinctively patterned or shaped buildings, and tapering the cluster downwards towards the River Thames and towards the important heritage parts of the city. I have to say that brave attempt at increasing office floor space, while it worked in that respect, did have the unfortunate impact of sparking a wave of high-rise rubbish across so much of Greater London. The whole of the River Thames from Greenwich all the way upriver to Battersea past Westminster on the south side of the river is now lined with piles and piles of what I have christened safety deposit boxes, simply investment residential towers for people with ill-gotten gains to park their gash capital. High is often not beautiful, and it certainly doesn't make places.
Yes, and I think it might surprise some people to know that members of our leadership have shared your view. My boss, Anthony Wood, has often said 95% of tall buildings are crap. And this is one of the reasons why, is because of the dynamics that are involved in creating them in the first place are almost entirely commercial. I'm wondering, given the changes that have happened, on account of COVID and the outbreak of the Ukraine war, if you've seen any difference in the number of applications or the type and style of applications for high rises, are we seeing a declination in the prevalence of these lockboxes in the sky for foreign capital, or has that just marched on with a different cast?
Just to take that apart, in terms of COVID, I'm living in a city which has in history endured the Black Death, Great Fire of London, which destroyed 80% of the city, the Blitz, the financial Big Bang, the banking crash. All of these were many times bigger in their impact than COVID could possibly be. We sometimes forget that COVID has killed less people than the Spanish flu did in the early 20th century. It's really no big deal, but it has come at a time when there are major changes in working practices and in lifestyle. Back at the end of 2007, beginning of 2008, with the banking crash, a lot of young people working for the financial institutions in the City of London lost their jobs with the financial crisis that ensued. They were too young to retire, didn't have enough money to retire anyway, and they had lots of ideas. So a lot of them wanted to set up their own businesses to further these ideas for new financial products or new fintech enterprises. They couldn't afford traditional city rents, but they didn't want to be far from the city. And the place that they moved to start their new businesses was Shoreditch, just to the north of the City of London. Meanwhile, a parallel action was going on in New York with people moving to Brooklyn. So Shoreditch and Brooklyn were the two prototypes in the world for the new way of working. I take my students on walks around Shoreditch and I say to them, look at that group of youngsters playing football in the street. They're working. If you could see on top of the roof in the middle of the summer, you'd find people sunbathing. They're working. That coffee bar's full of people and they're all working. People expect now to be able to merge leisure and work. They don't expect to have to go to the gym at 6 or 7 in the morning on the way to work. They expect to be able to leave their desk for a rest in the middle of the day and go off to the gym, say, at 10 o'clock in the morning. And enlightened companies are recognising that need. Work still needs to go on around the office. And I say to my students when they're graduating and going off to go to job interviews, don't take any job that won't give you a desk 5 days a week working with people who are working on the same projects, because otherwise you'll never learn anything. The idea of working from home is extremely selfish. It appeals to people that have already got on, have raised a family, got a good income, secure, and have learnt the craft, as it were, learnt their trade. The problem is that the 20 and 30 somethings coming up behind them will learn nothing if they're not sitting in an office alongside the more experienced people. The way you learn is through hearing people talking on the telephone and seeing how they handle a case or handle clients. The water cooler moments when you just overhear a conversation or you're able to ask a quick question of one of your colleagues. Being able to see when they're not up to their eyes and very busy, and being able to go over and ask them a question while you're working on something. None of that happens online. You're not going to ring up your superior or your boss to ask how to do something, or worse still, go on to Teams or Zoom to do it. So that process of mentoring will disappear if people work from home. And as a result, we will have far less efficiency, we will have huge social problems, a great deal of loneliness, and society will start to crumble, in my opinion. Because as I've seen throughout my life, the workplace, and place is an important word in workplace, the workplace is the centre of most people's social lives. It's where most young people find other young people that eventually become their partners. It's where they have their fun. It's where they learn. It's where they can impress the boss and progress. It is life. It is the focus of life, I should say. Whereas a home in some miserable suburb might be fine. It might have plenty of green space nearby. Might be a great place to bring up kids. But it's no place to have fun. And the success of the City of London has always been that it's a place people want to be. I know I was brought up in the provinces in South Wales. I couldn't wait to get to London to university because of the place that London was, because of the potential that London offered. I came for the fun. And people come to London for the fun from all over the world and get a job just to pay for the party.
Yeah, I can't imagine graduating today and being told that my future career would be in an apartment not much bigger than the dormitory that I'd just finished with or thought I'd finished with. I mean, when I graduated,
right. But there is a sort of a part two to this, which perhaps I should go on to. Interestingly, the area of Shoreditch, and I can't speak so well for Brooklyn, although I believe it's happening in the same way, but the area of Shoreditch, north of the city, this prototype area of the new way of working, was discovered by the realtors, as you call them, or the estate agents, as we name them. They saw this as being a trendy area because it had a mixture of nightlife and these vibrant startup businesses with young people. So they started looking into how they could sell off the buildings and convert them for residential use. The area therefore became much more expensive, and a lot of the startup businesses could no longer afford to pay the rent. Now, interestingly, you might have thought that they would then move further away, further outwards from the centre of London, to an even cheaper area. Not a bit of it. They've actually been gradually moving back into the City of London. So more and more buildings in the city are being used multi-purposed for pop-up businesses, for shared workspace. And in fact, although, as you know, there are questions about the business model, WeWork are the largest operators of property by floor space across the whole of the City of London, which shows that the startup, the shared business model, is now becoming the primary model for property occupation in the city. Now, the sort of buildings you need for that certainly aren't ego-boosting high-rise corporate towers. They are much more flexible buildings, probably no higher than 10 stories, and with easy access to the ground, because the ground and the spaces we create on the ground are the places where gossip occurs, and business cannot exist without gossip. Other people's gossip, not the gossip from within your own organisation. You already know that. So the more time your staff spend going out to get a coffee, going to the gym, going out to get a meal, going out and just doing their work outdoors, and that's increasingly happening in the City of London, the more likely they are to overhear something useful that will actually turn into something to boost your business.
Now, I know people love rooftops and people love to be above the city, and it's sort of an airy, gives them a sense of, you know, spatial, the prospect and shelter that I think Frank Lloyd Wright might have talked about. But then you have these projects like 20 Fenchurch, which tries to capitalize on that idea by placing more square footage in the sky than it actually occupies on the ground. But I've heard that it's not altogether successful. Do you see that as a sort of a solution or as a gossip machine, as you call it?
Fenchurch Street, 20 Fenchurch Street, was something rather different. Fenchurch Street was placing a public park on the top of the building in the sky, a bit like the High Line in New York. It was a place that everybody could go, rather than being a place simply for business gossip. It was a quid pro quo, if you like, for extra floor space on that site for a larger development that might otherwise have been permitted. And the site offered little opportunity for extra space at ground level. It has been successful. The reason it's not terribly successful at the moment is, of course, we've had a COVID lockdown. And although the park was in the open air, people would have had to use relatively small elevators to get to it. And therefore, it wasn't possible to provide public access during the period of COVID lockdown. I believe it will be successful again. It was before COVID came along. But that is, of course, no replacement for ground level space. I've always worried when people start talking about gardens in the sky bridges connecting the tall buildings of the city. It's always reminded me of the opening sequence from the 1920s silent movie by Fritz Lang called Metropolis, where we see this horrific vision of a city of the future where the rich live in the clouds and the poor live at or below ground level, keeping the city running, and their lords and masters up above, safe, secure, and supplied with energy. I would hate to think that our cities are moving in that direction. And that's why I'm such a great believer in the spaces that go on at ground level as being the things that make places. Let's compare it with music, for instance. A great piece of music, you can play all the chords correctly and it won't sound very inspiring, because the thing that makes the greatest performance of a fine piece of music is the spaces between. It's what comes, the air, if you like, that comes between the chords or notes of the tune and between the various sections of the tune. That's what gives it its overall flavour. And it's exactly the same with a place. It's not the buildings. You can create a wonderful place without architecture, provided the buildings are of the right scale, you have the right mixture of uses, and above all, you have spaces of the right proportions that are accessible and permeable. If you have all that, people will go to those spaces and they will start to gossip. And as soon as people arrive and gossip, you have a place.
You know, I would not picture or even consider proposing, you know, the superimposition of a multi-level skybridge city on a city like London or Paris, which is already very well established in terms of its urban fabric and its street level culture and, you know, just the charm of being in a city altogether is walking through the streets and making unexpected discoveries. But for some place that's new, where a lot of people are moving at once, or a place that might be at considerable risk of flooding or other types of climatic catastrophes, is there a place for this multi-tiered city which could be, you know, equitable? I mean, I think certainly places like Singapore have made an attempt at that, governance models aside.
Yes, it isn't just a case of equitability and providing people with access to homes at a high level and spaces at a high level and making sure that facilities are available to all. That is indeed important and is part of it. But it is very much to do with the way that people move around and come into contact with people and are able to identify with the place rather than simply feeling like guests within somebody else's creation. And I think that's much more likely to happen at ground level with a city of human scale. You're right, there are exceptions. The city of New York had the excuse that in Manhattan it was surrounded by water. They couldn't spread outwards, they had to go upwards. City of London, as I've described earlier, we had only one square mile. We couldn't impose our offices on the surrounding municipalities of Greater London, and therefore the only solution if we wished to grow was to go upwards. That was the case at Canary Wharf in London, the other financial centre, which again was surrounded by water and had to build vertically. Hong Kong, you could argue, has very little flat land to build on and a lot of people to house. Therefore, they have to be housed vertically rather than in horizontal developments. But I think most cities around the world can be better planned by being less tall. I think we tend to build tall because we want to, and then post justify it by saying, we've created extra density. And I always, when I'm taking my students on walks around London, say, now look, there's an 8-story tenement building, what I call a donut building. It's built around the four sides of the street block, shops and public uses facing outwards on the ground floor, central courtyard for the residents. The building is high enough that it doesn't even need elevators necessarily, and if they break down, it's not a disaster. There's a rooftop space for people that live within the block. And it's utilising that street block to the maximum development potential, while still allowing adequate daylight and air into the streets and spaces of the city. If you, instead of that, doing that, house the same number of people in a tall building on the next street block, then that block will generally be in the centre of the site or one corner of the site. And the space that you leave around it is unusable because it's surrounded by traffic noise and fumes. It isn't private. It just doesn't feel defensible. So people won't use it to sit in the way that they would in a courtyard. They won't meet in it in the way they would in a courtyard. Then, of course, you have to take away the areas of the floor plate of the building for elevators and service corps and things running vertically through the building. By the time you've done all that and built twice the height, you probably haven't increased the density at all. So high rise and high density are not necessarily the same thing. If you want to find good examples of working communities with very high densities, look at the favelas of South America. We have more to learn from the favelas in places like Brazil and Argentina than we have to teach them. And I'm always horrified when some of my students who've come over from South America to study in London say they can't wait to get back working for their governments and creating new developments to rehouse the people from the favelas. And I say, please don't do that. Go to the favelas, learn from them, find out what they need, replumb them, provide them with the modern services that they lack and the healthcare and the education that they're lacking. But for goodness sake, don't tear them down and replace them, because those people are much cleverer at planning than you will ever be.
And, you know, you could have said the same thing about, the East End in the 1950s. I'm sure there were plenty of proposals.
Absolutely.
Right?
And in fact, it's very interesting. Over the last few weeks, I've been taking trips out at the weekend into different parts of the East End of London from the city and going down along the riverside to see some of the new developments that are occurring and comparing what's happened. There are parts of the East End, as you say, that were very densely developed, but low rise with housing, streets where people knew each other, where there was a community. In the 1960s and post-war period, of course, a lot of people had to be rehoused because of the effect of the Blitz and houses having been destroyed. But many more houses were torn down and whole streets of people were moved out to the new towns of places like Stevenage and Bracknell and Harlow spread around the southeast of England with no community sense or spirit at all. And they lost so much more than they ever gained. They were suburbanized, having been people brought up in an urban surroundings. And it's so interesting now to see how those streets that remain in the East End are being gentrified. People are actually realizing just what good places they are to live, being close to the center of London at the same time, having a sense of human scale, and still a surviving sense of community with local shops, local facilities all within walking distance. Fascinating to compare that. You know, I always say that if you want to compare the two approaches to the extreme, look at a favela in Rio de Janeiro and Brasilia and compare the two.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, obviously we shouldn't be fetishizing poverty, but at the same time,
Absolutely not. I'm certainly not doing that. I'm saying that we can learn so much from communities that have created their own places.
Right.
Because it's not architects and planners alone that make places. It's the people that work and play and live there that make places. We simply help them to do it. The more we think we can do it for them, the worse the results will be.
Yes, exactly. So I think, obviously there are some city scale problems too that an individual neighborhood probably is not positioned to solve. London and any number of Western cities are amidst a housing crisis. And, the knee-jerk solution is to build lots and lots of, Panelax in the Eastern European style, or put up lots of social housing. That certainly hasn't worked to build communities. But investments in infrastructure surely need to happen. What do you think might be the shorter long-term solutions to the housing crises in cities like London?
First of all, we're at the mercy of people that are called politicians. Successive Democratic, Republican, Conservative and Labour governments on both sides of the Atlantic have pushed for universal home ownership. Now, in urban areas, that's the biggest mistake you can possibly make. It was the cause of the banking crash, because clever bankers invented a way of lending money to people to buy homes, knowing that those people would never be able to afford to pay the money back. They minced up this bad debt and hid it in the collateralized debt obligations, and that caused the banking crash. Most people living in an urban area would be perfectly happy to rent their homes, provided that they had sufficient security of tenure. In Germany, I think 50% of people in the whole country rent rather than own. Across the city of Paris, the vast majority of people rent their homes rather than own them. This is a sophisticated urban model of living. But in those cities, as long as you continue to pay your rent and you don't trash the property, then you're there for life if you wish to be. In fact, in some places, you're even able to pass on your tenancy to your descendants. In a place like London, where most of the rented property that exists is owned as a sort of private pension fund by rich individuals that are able to buy up more than one property, more than they need, and rent them out. In these sort of places, the tenants have no security of tenure. They can be thrown out at a few months' notice. So, of course, they can't regard it as their home. If all rented property was commercially operated, and developers would be perfectly happy to do this and are perfectly capable of doing this. After all, the whole of the West End of London was developed on this model of building houses, very grand houses for rent back in the 17th and 18th centuries. If we have this professionally managed view of making homes and places at the same time, the green spaces and all the other facilities that go with the homes, and then have them professionally managed, but giving people that live in them security of tenure, then I think we have a far better urban model. There is no shortage of housing in Greater London. There is only a shortage of access to housing, because we have vast quantities of housing that is either never lived in at all, or is lived in for only a few weeks a year. These are simply safety deposit boxes, as I've said earlier. So what we need to do is to find a mechanism for making the property we have available to the people that need it, and having a model which is flexible enough to give them security of tenure and at the same time to ensure that there's adequate housing stock for all.
So thinking again at this sort of larger scale, the recent coronation, shall we say, of the Elizabeth line was big news in London, mm-hmm. Also known as Crossrail. You also have HS2 underway with a high-speed rail system to the northwest, and then you have some proposals knocking around to perhaps build a Crossrail 2 should the money be found in the north-south alignment. Given where we are right now, both in the context of, the post-COVID world that's very sort of mushy and unclear about what our commuting patterns are going to be, and the status of Britain and with Brexit and everything else that's going on. Are these types of projects, you know, justified? Are they boondoggles? Do you think they're going to end up paying off?
Yes and no. First of all, we're thrilled to have the Elizabeth line. I'm sitting just a few hundred yards away from one of the stations on that line. I've been eagerly waiting its arrival. It is a great boon, running east-west under central London, and will shortly be connected up with some of the other suburban railway lines running to the east and west of London, making it even more useful. It's part of London's essential plumbing, and given the way London has grown over the last few decades, and given the popularity of London for people coming to work and to play and to visit as tourists, we need to have adequate public transport. So great support of that project. And okay, if it's a little bit over cost and a little bit over time, most of these things usually are, most of these sorts of projects, it's been well worth the wait. However, when it comes to something like HS2 and simply knocking half an hour off the journey from Birmingham to London, I think that's an example of politicians and transport planners taking the lead without any consideration for the impact that their project will have. If the same amount of money, the billions and billions of pounds of money that are being spent on it, had been spent in upgrading the existing railway infrastructure, improving the bottlenecks, or rather taking out the bottlenecks on those systems to increase capacity, you would have got a lot more for your money. Those existing lines have already run through the centres of places that people want to go to and get from, whereas the new line skirts places and has to create new centres along the way to provide interchanges. That will have a desperately negative effect on the nearby places that it just misses. But it's an example, I think, of two things. First of all, that transport planners have now got ahead of land use planners. They propose their projects and then they're sort of post-justified. And very often you have to then subsequently build developments to justify the transport project that's been built. But the other thing, of course, is it's easier for politicians to understand. There's a chance that a transport infrastructure project may be realised within their term of office, and therefore they will be able to draw the electoral credit for that project and get to cut the ribbon when it's opened. When it comes to major land use changes or regeneration of places, this usually takes decades. Politicians are too impatient for that. They want instant results. So they tend to favour the projects that are sort of oven ready and can be delivered within their electoral term. And I think that's why the transport projects are often so popular. So I'd be very careful. I would spend money on improving what we have and above all, reducing our future maintenance burden. I always think that the most important question you can ask whenever any major redevelopment or a regeneration project is proposed is, how will this impact on the future maintenance burden of the place? So often, if you build an extra railway line, you then have one more railway line that has to be maintained, as well as the ones that were already built before. There comes a point where the country or the community can no longer afford the amount of maintenance. We're seeing this equally with the tall buildings that are being constructed. I'm on the 27th floor of a residential block here on the edge of the City of London, surrounded by other blocks, many of which are still under construction. And when I look at those blocks, I think, well, okay, for offices, that's fine, because the buildings tend to be decanted at least every 25 years with a change of tenancies. There's an opportunity to recable the building, put in new elevators, to put new gaskets around the cladding on the outside and generally refurbish the building. And maybe once every 60 years to completely reskin the building because the cladding itself probably only has a 60-year life. But these buildings are being built for residential purposes. They're being sold on 125-year leases to residential owners. Now, long before that residential lease has expired, the cladding will have dropped off the building. So we need to be giving great thought to how we're going to maintain our buildings, our tall buildings especially. A lot of attention is being given to that in London following the awful Grenfell Tower fire where so many people were killed a couple of years back. On the safety aspect, but it isn't just the safety aspect, there is no financial mechanism for paying for this phenomenal cost that will come along at various stages in the 125-year life of the building for external recladding, for major infrastructure renewal within the building, the cabling and elevators. Residential service charges will never cover that kind of expense. Nobody seems to be thinking about that. And I think we have a huge catastrophe waiting to happen down the road with cities being full of derelict, unoccupiable high-rise buildings.
That's a rather dystopian picture, but it is one that is not difficult to conjure given these circumstances. It always shocks me when we talk about building tall buildings and we talk about a 100-year service life, which sounds like a long time, but considering that the tallest building ever to have been demolished was the Union Carbide building, then the J.P. Morgan headquarters in New York, about 200 meters, we have no idea how to demolish taller buildings. And
well, as you say, and we shouldn't be demolishing them anyway because of the embedded carbon and the sustainability aspects of it. But, you know, we really haven't given any thought to the fact that although the structure is probably good for 150 years, maybe even longer if it's well designed, the cladding on the outside certainly doesn't have that life scope. And the way the cladding is waterproof doesn't, and the mechanical plant and the cabling and all the things that make the building work have much, much shorter lifespans and are very, very expensive to replace.
I've also always been fascinated by the fact that if you walk around a city that dates to, say, 200 years or longer in the past, you will often see inscribed on the cornerstones or on the cornices of buildings the date of its construction, sometimes followed by AD, just so you know you're talking about,
indeed,
you know, the post the Christian era. There's an implication that these buildings, commercial or government, whoever's constructed them, that they're going to be there forever, that people are going to come across them like Roman ruins, you know, and they'll still be at least partially intact. You don't see that so much anymore, do you?
No, I mean, I remember back to my student days, the beginning of the 1970s, and there was an architect who was at that time the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects called Alex Graham. And Alex came out with a statement which I took to heart as a student, and I haven't heard it improved since. He said that any new building needs to have long life, loose fit, and low energy. And you really can't improve on that. I mean, the length of time the building stands up for is a key to its sustainability. The fact that it's adaptable and has sufficient headroom to allow for changes in technology in a way that our 1960s and 70s buildings didn't, but it isn't too tightly configured around its current use, the loose fit part, and of course, well, you know, the low energy thing we don't even have to mention these days because everybody should understand that one. But you can't do better than that. It's interesting now that there are one or two cases in London where new developments are being refused development permission because of the impact for the unsustainability of knocking down the existing building, that there isn't a predisposition to clearing sites and redeveloping them, that we need to look at the impact of losing a building in order to replace it with another one. And I think that's going to gather pace, not just in this country, but around the world, that people are going to be told, no, I'm sorry, you've got to keep your existing building. We can't afford to release that amount of carbon.
You know, that's an effective local carbon tax that is outside the world of, you know, global financial trading as it's currently, you know, presented, right? If the local authorities are saying, look, you've got to prove that you're not going to be releasing more carbon by not renovating this building and instead building a new one, that would be an interesting proposition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we need to be, we've been very good over the years, you know, in a civilization run often by accountants as much as by politicians, in having cost-benefit analysis of all that we do. I think we need to be moving much further towards life-benefit analysis. We need to be looking at how everything that's proposed impacts upon either making better places or making places better.
One of the things I wanted to be sure to ask was, and it sounds like you are, you've now moved into the education realm. Are you still giving tours of the city? And if so, what's on your must-see list?
Well, I do occasionally walk people around the city, and not necessarily just my own students. In fact, I always say to my students at the beginning of their course, I will never take them into a lecture theatre. Every week we're either on a visit to a professional practice or a development company or a development site, or going on a walk somewhere and having a walking tutorial. It would be crazy for me to be in a lecture theatre using PowerPoint to explain things to students when I've got a full-scale model just outside the door that can show everything you need to see in terms of development, mistakes and successes. The city, I'm always keen to impress people with how much of the old city, even the medieval street plan, is still left in the city and how important that is. I can remember, it must be about 10 years ago now, perhaps even a little bit longer, being emailed by the headmistress of a tiny little primary school on the English-Scottish border. I think it was a school with only about two classes, just serving a few villages. And she informed me that she was bringing a group of her nine-year-old children to London for 2 days. Apparently she did this tour every year with the children. And she had noticed something about me and the City of London on television and said that the boys in her class particularly were very enthusiastic about some of the new tall buildings in London with the very funny names like the Gherkin and the Walkie Talkie. And so she said, would I be prepared to talk to them and give them an introduction to these tall buildings? Well, I said, of course, I'd be delighted. We made it into quite an event. We got in touch with a local radio station and I did an interview over the phone, and the children were interviewed in their school playground before coming to London. Anyway, I first met with the children. It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. They travelled right down by train from some ungodly hour that they'd had to get up. They'd arrived in the marketing suite in the City of London with a vast model of the square mile in front of them and all these buildings modelled, eyes wide open. And so I turned to them and I said, all right, now I said, I want one of you to explain to me how the city works. And they looked at me as if I was completely mad, which of course I am. They were jet lagged, you know, they'd never been further than their nearest market town. They'd come all the way to London and this idiot was asking them to tell him how it worked. I said, all right, I'll ask you another question. Which of you can tell me how a beehive works? All the hands went up. They all knew how a beehive worked. They had one in their school with a glass side on it. They could describe it to me in minute detail. I said, right, now, if you look at that model of the gherkin over there, that's a beehive. But inside, you won't find bees, you'll find bankers. Bees make honey, bankers make money. Now then, how does a bee make honey? Well, they fly out of their hive, the children said, to find the flowers with the best nectar, usually around the compost heap. And they go and collect the nectar from inside the flowers. I said, well, the bankers are just the same. At lunchtime, they're out of those towers, down into the little alleyways of the city, the compost heap, to find the bars and the restaurants so that they can have a drink and something to eat. And I said, now then, what happens when the bees inside the flower collecting the nectar? And the children said, oh, well, they brush against the inside of the flower and they collect pollen on their hairs, on the body, and they take them to other flowers and that helps them to grow. I said, well, the bankers are just the same. I said, but it isn't pollen they collect, it's gossip. And they take that gossip back to the office and they make even more money as a result. Well, I didn't know whether the message had got across until a few days after the children returned to their school, when I received a delightful card with a painting that one of them had done on the front of the card, the others had written inside. But the painting depicted the Gherkin with a swarm of bankers in pinstripe suits with wings on their back flying out down into the alleyways. And I thought, they've got it. It can't be difficult to understand. Now, when I take walks around the city, I'm just as keen to show people, or even more keen, to show people the compost heap as I am to show them the beehives.
That's a very strong mental picture you've painted. And I can definitely see, a Terry Gilliam cartoon of winged bankers with bee-like features. Last question is more about your current role in at the university level. So we've heard how you've dealt with 9-year-olds, but as an educator at the university level, what do you think students of architecture and urban planning most urgently need to emerge from university knowing today? Most of the time, the people that I talk to who are architectural educators are really from the profession of architecture, but you're coming from the planning angle, so I'd be interested to get your take.
I think there's a danger in environmental education, but more specifically in architectural education, and I have to emphasize most of the students I'm working with are planning and urban design students rather than architecture students, but I do some of both. I think the danger with educating architecture students is there's been a belief for some time that you need to place students in a sort of hothouse environment, a sort of protected space, a bubble, where they're exposed to some of the finest thoughts on architecture, groomed by a tutor who is perhaps, without saying so much, developing clones of themselves. And you have this very intense, inward-looking attempt at releasing and developing the creative juices of those students. Not surprisingly, when those young architects are released into the wild, they either have a great surprise as they meet reality, or alternatively do a great deal of damage as they inflict on real human beings these abstract ideas which they've gathered. I feel that the important thing with education in planning and architecture is maximum contact with reality, especially with mistakes. We so focus on showing people the best examples or the award-winning buildings. We perhaps don't show them enough of the ones that have gone wrong, the ones that are unpleasant to look at or don't work well, or in fact, even the building disasters. I think there's much more to learn from those mistakes than there is from trying to copy the great masters in buildings that have become famous. Also, I think that we need to give students practice in dealing with their customers. In the academic module that I teach, which is for postgraduate urban design students, the final project is to make a 10-minute video of an area that is going to be impacted by an adjacent development. In order to inform the developer of the key characteristics of that local community, and the pressures and potential impacts that their development could have upon it. So the students go out and actually make contact with local communities, find out what their concerns and issues are, observe, take some very interesting visual material and audio material, because so very often it's the sounds of a place. I had one wonderful 10-minute video this last term called The Sounds of Somerstown, where it told you everything you needed to know about that area through the different sounds that you could hear in different parts of the community. I think if we get them thinking in that sort of way and realizing that they need to work alongside the community from day one, I mean, it parallels something I always used to say to developers when I was working in the city. I always used to say, as chief planner, I want you to come to see me at what we call the back of the envelope stage, a British expression for, you know, your first thoughts, the back of the envelope that you make your first sketches on. Come to see me at the back of the envelope stage, but please make sure that your architect hasn't drawn on the envelope first. And the reason for saying that was that the architect needed two briefs. They needed the one from the developer about the proposed land use and the density of development and the costs and various other things that the developer needed to have incorporated into their project. But equally, they needed the brief from the local planner about the local constraints, about the community issues, about connectivity with public transport, and all of those sorts of things. Now, only when the architect had received the planning brief as well as the development brief, could they go away and start to solve the problem. Now, really, we should be doing even one step before that, because we should be involving the community, not just the local planner representing the community, but the community itself at the earliest possible stage. The other thing is, of course, it makes development so much easier in the long run, because if you prepare a development to the nth degree, and then consult the public, inevitably you will have opposition, because there's nothing else for people to do. They can't come on board and support something. The only way they can show any sort of impact is by opposing. If you've involved them from the earliest stage, then there is something of them in the project, and they're far more likely to support it when it comes forward for development approval. So teaching students how to work with and involve people, the users of what they're doing, is the most important thing of all, because the best project, however brilliantly original it might be in its use of materials or its three-dimensional form, is never going to be a success unless it's taken into account the needs of those who will use it and those who live nearby.
Well put. Well, we are running up against our time window here, but I really want to take this opportunity to thank you again for taking the time with us. And you've been hearing today from Peter Rees, Professor of Place, University College London. And if you're ever in London, I highly recommend looking him up and taking one of his tours, if you can convince him.
Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Bye-bye.
Goodbye now.